From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Ghost to Ghost begins right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, computer makers are recalling 100,000 laptop battery packs made by the Sony Corporation after 40 reports now of overheating. This is according to the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. The voluntary recall applies to certain Sony 2.15 lithium-ion cell batteries made in Japan and sold around the world in laptops made by Hewlett-Packard and Dell and Toshiba. Some incidents involve smoke or flames, according to Sony. 21 of the reports claim minor damage and small burns reported in 4 cases. So just check out your batteries. Several minor earthquakes gave some Texas and Oklahoma residents an early Halloween scare. No damage or injuries reported there. 2.5 magnitude, 3.0 magnitude. A Warren County, Ohio magistrate said he'll decide Saturday whether Ohio Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner has to get proof that Barack Obama was born in the United States. David M. Neal, who runs a political website, filed suit last week saying state and federal government leaders have failed to verify that Obama was born in Hawaii instead of Kenya. The U.S. Constitution requires presidents to be natural-born citizens who are at least 35 years old. Well, the longest daylight saving time period in American history ends Sunday, November 1st, when all states except for Hawaii, most of Arizona, and parts of Indiana will dial back the clock 1 hour. So you do that Saturday night just when you're ready to go to bed. Actor Patrick Swayze has said that undergoing chemotherapy for pancreatic cancer was hell on wheels. The 56-year-old star told the New York Times that he's still going through a battle zone despite a return to acting following intensive treatment. He says, "I'm proud of what I'm doing," said Swayze, who's playing the lead in a television police drama called The Beast. "I ran into him before his treatment started in Los Angeles, and at that time he looked pretty good, actually. And, you know, now obviously, you know, he's been battling this." In Michigan, moments after rolling the first perfect 300 game of his life in bowling, Don Doan collapsed on the floor while high-fiving his teammates. The 62-year-old was taken to a local hospital, could not be saved. A medical examiner determined that a heart attack killed him. But man, what a way to go. They call it phantom clowns, and there apparently have been sightings of these things. Cryptozoologist Lauren Coleman on the line with us now. Lauren, what are these sightings?
Well, these sightings are of clowns supposedly carrying balloons. This has happened in the Chicago area starting October 7th, October 10th of this year. And they're said to approach children, try to kidnap them, and the children are running away and calling 911. And I coined the term phantom clowns in 1981. When we had a wave of these in Boston all the way to Kansas City. The local communities didn't know that it was a national phenomenon. I heard about it through my correspondence and exchanging news clippings and different things like that. But it's I call them phantoms, of course, because they're never caught. They're seen in these vans with broken windows or a ladder on them, and yet the police can never capture them.
Lauren, how come there isn't any widespread media coverage on this?
I don't know. I think that it's always seemed to be some kind of local phenomena, almost at the level of hysteria. But yet local communities, police officers, and school districts take it very seriously. They send alerts out. They send community neighborhood alerts out. And yet we never hear about it nationally.
Now, right now, is this restricted primarily to the Illinois area specifically, near Chicago?
Yeah. I'm hearing that it's spreading down to the Bloomington area, you know, from the Chicago area. And then also, I just got a new report that one of these was seen in Seattle, in the Seattle area. So it may be something that could be spreading and jumping.
Absolutely bizarre. So the warning here, take heed. If somebody dressed like a clown comes up to a child or your child, don't go with the clown. Right, Lauren?
Right. Go to a police officer. Go to a responsible adult.
And there's a story about this on CryptoMundo.com. Lauren Coleman. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you, George. Happy Halloween.
You too, my friend. Campaigners in London plan to petition the British government for a posthumous pardon for the hundreds of people executed for witchcraft between the 16th and 18th centuries. They said that Halloween is a good time to highlight the grave miscarriage of justice suffered by the men and women falsely accused of being witches. Their petitions ask a Justice Minister, Jack Straw, to recommend that Queen Elizabeth II pardon them. The Bell Witch, a ghost story from Southern folklore. The legend of the Bell Witch, also called the Bell Witch Haunting, revolves around strange events allegedly experienced by the Bell family of Adams, Tennessee in 1817 and again in 1935 when the so-called witch had promised to return. What does this all mean? Pat Fitzhughes joins us as we talk about the Bell Witch, the full account, next on Coast to Coast AM. Pat Fitzhugh has researched the legend of the Tennessee's infamous Bell Witch for 30 years, and many consider this to be the world's scariest haunting. Pat's research has led him to official records, old manuscripts, and interviews with people from around the world. Pat has played a consultative role in numerous made-for-television documentaries and has written paranormal phenomena in newspapers, magazines all around the world. Author of The Bell Witch, the full account. Here he is this hour on Coast to Coast. Pat, happy Halloween to you, my friend. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great, and happy Halloween to you, too.
Good, good. The Bell Witch. When did you first hear the Bell Witch legend?
I first heard it as a small child. My mother would read me the Bell Witch stories. It scared me to death, but it intrigued me at the same time. And then later on, I learned that the people and places mentioned in the legend were real, and that's when I began researching it, you know, from a more serious standpoint. And I've been researching it ever since.
Tell us about the legend, Pat.
Well, the legend involves the John Bell family of the Red River Settlement in Middle Tennessee. Back in 1817, John Bell noticed a strange animal in his cornfield, and it had the head of a rabbit and the body of a dog. And he fired a shot, and it just vanished. Not vanished in terms of running away, but just plain vanished. Then a short time thereafter, the family began experiencing a series of knocking sounds on the walls of their house late at night. And they would go out to try and catch the culprit, but wouldn't find anyone. Yet they would hear the knocking sounds continue. So it was like the knocking sounds were coming from inside of the walls themselves. Then after that, a short time after that, the kids began complaining about their bed covers being pulled. And when they would resist, their faces would be slapped by an invisible hand, and there were welts and visible prints all over their faces. Then a short time later, this thing gathered more energy and began beating the youngest daughter, Betsy Bell, and allegedly tying her hair in knots, making her vomit brass pins, and just go into all kinds of trances and other strange positions. Then, at the same time all this was going on, it began to develop a voice, first as a small, very quiet whisper, and later on as a full-fledged voice that you could actually understand. And people would ask this thing what it was and what it wanted and why it was tormenting everybody, and all it could say, it would say a different thing each time they asked. It's like it was playing a game with them. Sent them on a lot of wild goose chases. Then one thing it said stood out in particular was that they wanted to kill the patriarch of the family, John Bell, but it never said why. Then as time went on, the word got out and visitors would come from all around, and they too could experience this phenomena going on in the Bell household. And later it spread throughout the Red River community where this invisible or seemingly invisible entity would attend church services and tell the local gossip, would tell visitors to the Bell home about their pasts and predict the future, and just all sorts of wonderful things. But at the same time, tormenting the Bell children, especially Betsy Bell and Mr. Bell, John Bell.
Did it get John Bell eventually? Because I had heard that he had suffered frequent facial seizures And one day they gave him some medicine, and he died right after that, right?
Okay, well, the Bell Witch entity is credited by many people as being the killer of John Bell. He died in December of 1820, and according to the legend, they found a vial of strange liquid, dark liquid, sitting next to his bed. And the family didn't know where it came from. They summoned the local doctor. He came. He didn't know what it was. And one of John Bell's sons poured some of it on his finger and rubbed it on their cat's tongue. And the cat died immediately.
Oh, my.
And according to the legend, the entity spoke up at that time and said, well, I gave John Bell a dose of that last night, and it fixed him. And then it began singing. It was very, very happy about the death of John Bell, and reportedly even sang songs, happy, cheerful songs, as he was being lowered into the ground at his funeral.
Now, did people see the entity, Pat, or did they just hear it?
Well, they mostly heard it. The entity claimed on several occasions that it liked to manifest in the form of a rabbit. And there were several instances where people would report seeing rabbits acting strangely, and then later on the entity would say, well, that was me. Also, on one occasion, the Bell children saw a very strange, very distant-looking old lady walking about the pear orchard behind the house. And as they approached her to say hello, she walked behind a tree, and they never saw her again. Then there's also the story of where some of the family were hiking through the woods, and they came upon this tree, and there was a lady hanging from the tree, dead. And then they ran, and they looked back, and she wasn't there. So there have been some apparitions, but mainly this thing was, you know, a poltergeist-type entity, at least in the early stages, with a lot of furniture being shifted, banging on the walls, and things like that. And then later on, it got to where it would talk.
And this was around 1817, but then somewhere around 1935, this entity resurrected somehow, did it?
Okay, well, it left in 1821 after it broke up Betsy Bell and her boyfriend, where they couldn't get married, then reappeared in 1828 for about 3 weeks, had some serious conversations with John Bell Jr., and then promised to return in 1935. And whether it returned or not really depends on who you talk to. I know my mother was alive and well and lived right there in 1935, and she said that, you know, she didn't know anything about the thing ever returning. But there were some old-timers who, you know, many years ago told me that the thing had returned, that things, strange things began happening. And, you know, some people say it never left the place to begin with because there's always been strange things going on up there.
Pat, why did they call this entity a witch?
Okay. Back then, any time people, especially in this area of the South, encountered something that they didn't understand and which was they felt was more powerful than they were, they would attribute it to witchcraft. You've got to remember that this was roughly 125 years after the Salem witch trials, and several people who later wrote about their firsthand and eyewitness experiences with this entity referred to it as a witch, even though personally I don't feel that it was a witch, or the result of witchcraft for that matter, but that was the name that they gave it, and that's what has stuck.
This entity, whatever it was, you're an expert on this. You know, you've got a website devoted to it, bellwitch.com. You've written a book about it, The Bell Witch, The Full Account.
Okay, it was bellwitch.org. I'm sorry.
.org? Okay, fine. And we'll correct that because we got .com on the website. Ours. But what do you think it was, Pat?
Well, it's hard to pin down exactly what it was. I know a lot of people say it was a poltergeist, and although it did exhibit poltergeist-like characteristics throughout the entire haunting, especially in the earlier stages, in the later stages, it exhibited behavior that would suggest more of a demonic presence. For example, at one point, it divided itself into four distinct entities, and there was a hierarchy where one entity was over the others. And a lot of books I've read and study I've done has suggested that demon families are arranged in such a hierarchy. And also, this thing had a propensity for discussing and arguing religion. And it is said that no matter what scripture a preacher could quote to this thing, it could quote another scripture to contradict it or to argue back. And, you know, I found in a lot of studies I've done on demonology, things like that, that demons have a very, very thorough knowledge of the scripture. So I don't think it was just a poltergeist. I think it was a lot of different things involved there.
You know, EVP sounds are sometimes very difficult to hear when we hear them on tape. But I understand that the people who heard this Bell Witch heard a pretty understandable voice, didn't they?
Yes. According to the legend, it took a year or two for the voice to fully materialize. And when it spoke, it allegedly spoke in low musical tones when it was content and very high, shrill tones when it was excited. Now, it seems, you know, this whole entity and everything it did increased over time, like it fed off of the terror or the attention that it got.
Now, did anybody ever since 1935 talk about the Bell Witch as coming back?
All the time, actually. I receive emails all the time, plus I get to meet a lot of people at speaking engagements and things like that. And I'm always hearing stories of Bell Witch encounters, and even though all of them aren't necessarily believable, a good number are. You know, simply by the way these accounts are worded, you know, that are described rather, and where they took place. I think the most common account is, or phenomena nowadays, would be anomalous photographs. There's a lot of those out there with mist, and there's a few good orb photos, and a lot of also accounts of where people will see what looks like candle lights floating up and down out in a field, one of the fields that used to be part of the John Bell farm, some strange incidents with some black dogs, and several other things. You know, I don't think it's ever stopped there. And I'm not completely sure that what people experience today is the same entity that John Bell and his family experienced, especially when you look at what happened to them, you know, literally happened to them, and then you look at what's happened to these people today, where they only see and experience this entity when they're there, and, you know, they're not actually beaten up.
Tell me about the local woman by the name of Kate Batts.
Okay, Kate Batts was the lady that lived a couple of miles from the John Bell farm, and she was in a pretty bad position because her husband was injured in some type of accident on the farm and was paralyzed. And she had to run her farm. She had to run the farm, and then her children helped her. And they had very, very little money as compared to a lot of other people in the settlement, and that was something I looked at in my research, you know, estate settlements to see how much all these people were worth.
Right.
And she was kind of, frowned upon by the community. A lot of people said she was strange, and, you know, one antidote in the Bell Witch legend is that the Bell Witch claimed to be Kate Batts' witch. So people just jumped all over that, and they even began calling this thing Kate. But now, personally, off of my research, you know, I haven't found any connection at all that would, you know, suggest that she was the Bell Witch. I know a lot of people are still trying to perpetuate the myth that she had a bad business deal with John Bell and she came back to haunt him from the grave. But that business deal was actually with a Benjamin Batts, who was her brother-in-law. Plus, Kate Batts outlived John Bell. So, she's received a lot of the blame, and I don't think that she's responsible for it.
The home, the Bell home, was it built on anything unusual, any kind of special ground?
There are various credible reports from state of Tennessee archaeologists that confirm that there are several Native American burial grounds nearby. As to whether the house was built right on top, I don't know, but I know there are some burial grounds nearby.
All right, stay with us, Pat. We're going to open up the phone lines. We're going to continue talking with you about the Bell Witch, but we'll also take phone calls if you want to talk with Pat Fitzhugh about the Bell Witch. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Ghost to Ghost begins. We'll also come right back and be talking with Pat Fitzhugh about the Bell Witch in just a moment. Now, Saturday night, of course, Ian Punnett is with us with one incredible guest, Ian.
I'll get you, George Norrie, and that little Ian Punnett, too.
They're after us, Ian. They're after us.
That's great. There it is. You love Russell Targ. I know you do.
Yes.
He's got his biography out, his autobiography, and we're going to be talking about his life, both as the pioneer in so many of the interesting science projects of the last century, but also as a remote viewer. And this coming from Russell Targ. Now, have you ever met him in person? Do you
know I have not. I've been to so many conferences, but I haven't met him. But, you know, he was the original, as you know, he was one of the original remote viewers put together by the government.
Well, you know that if you ever met him and then you saw him again, he wouldn't know you or me or anybody.
Why?
He has the unique disease of or a condition where he cannot recognize faces. It's facial blindness.
Amazing.
And so this is part of the story of his book and about his life is and part of the unique ability of his ESP that has developed at an early age is that he has this great mental vision, but his close friends always walk up and identify themselves by name, and then he knows who you are. But he can never remember faces and cannot recognize them.
That's fantastic.
It
okay, have
amazing,
a great show, my friend. Okay, but happy Halloween to you, too.
Thank you. You have a great show. I'm looking forward to hearing Ghost to Ghost. I'm sitting on my porch with a fire and my radio on, and I'll
That's
be listening to George.
That's the way to do it.
Thanks.
Ian Punnett, he'll be on Saturday night, and I'll be on Sunday night, first Sunday of every month. When we come right back, let's continue talking about the Bell Witch. Take your phone calls with Pat Fitzhugh on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie, Pat Fitzhugh with us as we talk about the Bell Witch and your calls. Pat, do you think that this case will ever get solved?
Well, I believe that, you know, before anyone can really say that the case is solved, they have to formulate some criteria as to what constitutes solving the case. Ever since the very beginning of the legend, or when it, you know, when it was first commercially published back in the 1800s, people have come up with various theories and proclaimed that they've solved the legend. But other people will come in and say, well, no, this is not a good theory, or this couldn't have happened, and so on and so forth. So I don't really know that it's going to be solved, at least not with any terms of, you know, universal acceptance. And I think all of that goes back to one thing, and that is different people have different standards of proof.
Absolutely. Let's go to first-time caller David in Del Rio, Texas. You're on Coast to Coast with us, David. Hello there.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good, good. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much. Hey, pardon me, I'm a little nervous in this stuff. First-time caller here, but love y'all's show. It's great, very informative, stuff like that. But I wanted you to check out a website here, our local paper here. One of the staff photographers has got an awesome picture of an orb in a cemetery. Now, bear in mind that this particular cemetery, there's several here in Del Rio, okay? This particular one where this orb was actually photographed is very, very old. It was the first cemetery established here in Del Rio for its first settlers here. And unfortunately, it's very dilapidated. You know, it's really run down. And as a matter of fact, I believe it's part of the historic district here in Del Rio.
Any dates on the headstones, Pat? David?
Oh, absolutely. They're from the 1800s. It's very old. And if you log on to www.delrionewsherald.com on Friday, October 31st, and look up the story, A Haunting Place, I'm hoping you'll be able to see a picture of it. Like, it's headlined in our little local paper here, and it's an you know, and like I was saying, this cemetery is very run down, it's very dusty. You know, this whole area here is just very dusty. And
those are the perfect ones, David, for hauntings like that. What is it about the 1800s, Pat?
Oh, well, it's just, you know, enough time has passed that, you know, people have ignored the graveyards. They've fallen into an ill state of repair. And I know some researchers feel that because of that, that the paranormal activity increases, possibly as a form of anger from the other side as to, you know, their graves haven't been kept up.
What do you think that this bizarre animal that the Bell shot at, that the John Bell shot at, that had the body of a dog and the head of a rabbit, what significance do you think this animal played in any of this?
Well, that was the first antidote that we know about of the Bell Witch legend. And there's two ways that's been looked at. One, which is from the paranormal side, is that in the Native American culture, there's a spirit called Trickster. And several very knowledgeable Native Americans have told me that and a few other apparitions sounded very much like manifestations of the Trickster spirit. The other angle to look at that from, being the more human, non-paranormal angle, is that an animal with the head of a rabbit and the body of a dog is generally referred to as a hare, H-A-R-E. At least that's what they look like.
Huh. All right, let's go to Knoxville, Tennessee, east of the Rockies. Hey, Matt, take it away.
Hey, George. Hey, Pat. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Welcome.
My ex-wife claims to be a descendant of the ghost that lived in the house. They said she was an Indian woman named Nancy Ward. Have you ever heard anything about that?
No, I sure haven't.
All right, tell us more, Matt.
I guess the story goes that before she became incorporeal or whatever, she was supposed to have been a Native American shaman or something, and she changed her husband into a horse after she caught him cheating and rode him through the town square. I don't know about the validity of it. I just wondered if you had ever heard the name Nancy Ward or...
How about the story, Pat? Have you heard that?
No, not at all, at least not connected with the Bell Witch. And one thing we have to remember about the Bell Witch haunting is that Adams, Tennessee did not become a town until many years later. Back then, it was just a little settlement along the Red River. But I don't know of anything, you know, where a husband or anybody was changed into a horse or the name Nancy Ward. Perhaps it was something that occurred or is thought to have occurred in the area, but I've never seen anything along the lines of the Bell Witch in that.
Interesting, though, that you mentioned Native American shaman built on hollowed ground there. Let's go to you, Brian, in Honolulu. You're on the air with us. Hey, Brian.
How y'all doing tonight?
Good.
Okay, I got a kind of humorous story. I'm in Honolulu now, but I grew up in Clarksville, Tennessee. And when we were youngins, we'd always test our mettle. There was a saying that if you ate an apple in a dark bathroom and turned around three times counterclockwise and looked into the mirror and said, "I hate the Bell Witch," three times, that she would come out of the mirror and scratch your face. But, of course, us being so young, none of us really had, you know, we weren't brave enough to do it, but we'd sure start it. We'd just never finish it.
I don't think there's any young person in Tennessee who hasn't tried that. And I know I tried that when I was very small myself. And something bad happened to me, but I don't think it was the Bell Witch. I spun around so many times that I became dizzy and tripped and fell and busted my head all over the bathtub. So that was the only experience I'm afraid I had. But that whole thing about the spinning around in front of the bathroom mirror and so on and so forth, that originally came from another legend, or was associated with another legend, called I believe it was Bloody Mary. And then later, it somehow became adapted to the Bell Witch legend.
Do you believe the Bell Witch legend is indeed just that, myth and legend, or do you think there's some truth behind it, Pat?
I think there's a little bit of both. I mean, there's certainly quite a few things that I found in my research that suggest that certain anecdotes that were told were, in fact, true. At the same time, some of the anecdotes that comprise this massive legend, they don't have any proof behind them. And as a researcher, you know, for me to say something is real, I have to see black and white paper. And I have to have the handwriting analyzed, the paper dated, everything before I'm going to say something is absolutely documented and true. And, you know, the part about the Bell Witch turning the slave into a mule and riding him across the river, or turning a man into a rabbit, you know, I haven't seen any scientific proof that that really happened.
Let's go to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where Michelle is. Hey, Michelle, go ahead.
Hey, guys. Happy Halloween.
You too.
I'd like to know whether or not the home is still there.
One more time, a little louder.
Whether the home is actually still there.
Is the Bell House still there?
No. The house has been gone for a long time, unfortunately.
It was one of those old log cabins, wasn't it?
Right, an old two-story log house.
Next up, Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, James, take it away. You're on the air with us.
Hey, glad to hear you.
Sure thing.
There's a urban legend. I know some librarians around here about books about the Bell Witch always coming back late. And then the person will say, you know, well, it was someplace I looked a bunch of times but just never saw it. So I was wondering if you had ever heard that one.
Yeah, all the time. And, you know, I don't really know what's making those books late, but a lot of, you know, when I go around to the libraries and do the speaking engagements and things, the librarians will tell me the same thing. As a matter of fact, a lot of the libraries that carry my book, they keep it in the reference section, and they no longer allow it to be checked out because it seems like every time they do, it's either very late or it just, you know, vanishes. You know, there's a lot of demand for Bell Witch books, and you know, people read the book, they like it, they loan it to their friend never gives it back, and, you know, the book becomes history at that point.
Have you tracked any of the family, Pat, from John Bell Sr.?
Oh, yeah.
I even wonder if Art Bell's related to that. Yeah, you never know.
No, actually, he's not. I looked into that a long, long time ago. Somebody had asked me that, and I believe one of your guests one time was asking about that, too. I do have a pretty extensive genealogy section. It's on the website at www.bellwitch.org. All you have to do is click on the genealogy link, and you can view it online. Or you can, if you have a PDF viewer, you can actually download the report.
All right, next up, we go to Ray in Phoenix, Arizona. First-time caller. Ray, you're on with Pat. Go ahead.
Well, hello, Pat. Hello, George. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Hey, Ray. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Are you familiar with Paulson Rhodes over in Adams?
Could you run it by me again? I'm sorry. I didn't catch it.
That's okay. Paulson Road in Adams.
What is that, Ray?
It's the road that it's in Adams, and it parallels the Red River. And I moved over there in August of 1990. And I guess across the river is about three-quarters of a mile to Bell Witch Cave. And I have a fairly large home with a big balcony, and it was real dark out there, and I had some ridgebacks. And very frequently, we would see orbs coming across the river from the direction of the cave. And my dogs would get all excited, and they'd run after them. And it seems like during that time frame, there were a significant number of orbs and sightings, more like filmous, you know, type objects, white gauze type objects going through the woods there.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with Tolleson Road, and actually from Tolleson Road all the way back to Red River, that whole bottomland corridor, whatever you want to call it there, has been notorious for orb sightings as well as even solid balls of light. Not just the misty balls of light.
I've seen the solid ones, too. It's kind of interesting because the Red River Baptist Church was had its 200th anniversary during that time frame in 1992.
Right.
And they had a significant library of previous members, including the Bell family. And there were notations about various objects and various things that occurred that I didn't find in other books. Unfortunately, the church burnt down a few years ago.
How convenient.
Yeah, there was a pretty damaging fire, but thankfully it did not destroy the entire church. The records of the Red River Baptist Church at the time of John Bell are available. I use those extensively in my research. I know they could be found at the library in Clarksville, Tennessee. At least a transcribed copy can be. And another version of the transcribed copy, I bought one from a church member. You know, I donated some money to the church in exchange for a copy of the records. And I think you can get the records that way, too. But there's no mention of the Bell Witch, but there's quite a few mentions of John Bell, including the time he got excommunicated or kicked out of the church, which was right during the time period of the haunting. But it wasn't, or at least it wasn't listed as because of the Bell Witch, but because of a dispute regarding the sale of a slave that he had with a man named Benjamin Batts. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Couple productions leading up to The American Haunting in 2006, films based on the Bell Witch. What do you think of them? Were they accurate?
Yeah, well, you know, as a researcher, that's the first thing I look at when I'm looking at a Bell Witch movie or book or anything else is the accuracy or how closely they conform with the records on file at the different museums and courthouses and things like that. One movie in particular, The Bell Witch Haunting, which was a semi-low-budget film actually made here in Middle Tennessee, I feel is the most accurate portrayal of the legend. It also introduces a lot of comedy, which I think that's okay, a little comedy relief here and there, but it's very accurate historically. Then you have another one that's called An American Haunting. And, you know, I enjoyed American Haunting from the standpoint of it being, you know, a thriller, and there was some pretty nifty camera work. But in terms of historical accuracy, I didn't see a whole lot of that in there. You know, I'm not saying it was necessarily a bad movie, but I just, you know, I didn't agree with the ending, and a lot of the events in the movie weren't too familiar to me.
Okay, let's go now to Patrick in Cottontown, Tennessee, east of the Rockies. Patrick, go ahead.
Hey there. How are you guys doing tonight?
Good. Great.
Great.
Good, good. Pat, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I have had an opportunity to go out to the site, to the actual Bellwitch Cave area, and it's interesting. You had a caller previously that had lived right there in the area, right off Tollison Road, I guess around the Keysburg Road area, about 1990. He noticed a lot of orbs happening. I don't know if you, and you probably do know this, but I went there to the cave to visit actually on Halloween night about 1990 or 91. And as you know, from time to time, you know, this land is sold, you know, there'll be a different family will buy it. And some families will leave it open for tourists to come in and actually check the cave out. Others close it down. It was interesting, this particular night, I was told that the reason why it was shut down that night was that the owner of that land actually committed suicide a week previous to us going there. So it seemed to kind of coincide with the fact that there are orbs and what have you happening there. But I also wanted to mention this, too. That whole Highway 25, and I happen to live off of Highway 25 in Cottontown, that whole area up there, wasn't that part of the Trail of Tears?
The Trail of Tears. Well, let me reverse.
Hey,
for just
Pat,
a second.
We've got to run, but the Trail of Tears, very quickly, what was that?
It was where Andrew Jackson marched the Native Americans westward. It ran about 6 or 7 miles from present-day Adams, Tennessee.
Ah, okay. Pat Fitzhugh, our guest, his website, bellwitch.org. Ghost to Ghost starts in a moment.